Blog Talk Radio.
Doesn't Aretha just make you want to get up and dance? It does me every single time. So welcome to this special edition of Coffee Party Radio. And this is the first of our monthly event calls. And tonight we're just excited to be hosting a conversation on Ralph Nader's page-turning Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. So we're going to start off the show today with an interview that Eleanor LeCain, who is one of our guests, did with Ralph Nader back in September, and it aired on the Progressive Radio Network. And I just want to say a big shout-out to Eleanor for doing the interview and then allowing us to rebroadcast it. And Janine is going to be helping me out on the switchboard tonight, so for those of you who listen to Coffee Party Radio often, you know that Janine and I often get together to do these radio shows. So thanks, Janine, for helping out tonight. And I think let's get started with the Ralph Nader interview, and then we'll come back and we'll have a conversation with Joan Blades, who's the co-founder of Living Room Conversations, and with Eleanor about her interview with Ralph, and then whoever calls in to talk to us. Let's hit it. Thanks, Janine.
You're welcome.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Corporations have huge influence in our government, which they use to gain tax breaks, government subsidies, and policies that favor their companies. Corporate influence distorts every area of government, from energy to the food we eat and the air we breathe. How can we stop the growing power of corporations? Will the left and right join together and take back our government for we the people? Here to address this vital issue is Ralph Nader, the nation's leading consumer crusader and public defender. Mr. Nader first made headlines in 1965 with his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, a scathing indictment of the auto industry for producing unsafe vehicles that led to the passage of auto safety laws. Nader went on to champion major federal consumer protection laws, from motor vehicle safety to the Safe Drinking Water Act, and help launch federal agencies such as OSHA and the Environmental Protection Agency. Ralph Nader has founded numerous organizations such as Public Citizen and inspired legions of consumer advocates, citizen activists, and public interest lawyers who in turn have established their own organizations throughout the country. His national network of citizen groups have had a major impact in areas ranging from tax reform to nuclear energy to health and safety. Nader has dedicated his life to empowering people to create a government responsive to citizens' needs so we can have a better society. Today, Nader focuses on the growing power of multinational corporations and the dangerous convergence of corporate and government power. His most recent book is Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph Nader, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you very much.
Your recent book, Unstoppable, I think is your best work yet, and it examines the possibility of a left-right alliance to take on the corporate state. How would you summarize the core argument of your book?
Well, the argument is that left-right sense that corporations are dominating our entire political economy in ways that spell dictatorial power and over-commercialization of our cultural and spiritual life. So what we're seeing here is a common recognition by left-right that government has been turned into a guarantor of corporate misbehavior and speculation, such as Wall Street, a guarantor, and that comes from corporations swarming over Washington, putting their people in top government positions, funding all kinds of candidates or incumbents, and turning Washington into a servant of Wall Street, otherwise known as the corporate state. The left calls it corporate welfare, and the right calls it crony capitalism. Under that umbrella of convergence between left and right are a lot of issues, some quite surprising. For example, operationally now, there is a left-right convergence behind restoring the minimum wage, at least to what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation, which would take it from a federal level of $7.25 to $10.92 now. There may be quibbling or on the edges, but when you come in 70-80% in the polls supporting a restored minimum wage, that includes a lot of conservative workers in Walmart and elsewhere. But on other issues, there's a convergence. There's a growing convergence against what I call bailout capitalism. That is, if you're too big, then you're too big to fail. Then you collapse on the back of the taxpayers who bail you out. The very people who are the workers and consumers and investors who have been gouged, fleeced, and shattered by your speculation in the first place. There's also a growing left-right against empire and foreign wars of aggression that are boomeranging on us. And that partly is because the right sees it as a huge waste of taxpayer money and unconstitutionally non-authorized. You know, it's they're constitutionally compliant people. They think that only Congress can declare war, and that's what's in the Constitution, not the president. And on the left, it's the repression of people around the world, civilians, people who want to challenge their own dictatorships that are propped up by U.S. military and diplomatic and economic cover. So those are three big areas, but there are a lot of other areas as well. I think the Patriot Act is coming up for renewal next year. And in the prior two times when this anti-civil libertarian law that came out of the panic after 9/11 with no hearings pushed through by Bush and Cheney, the renewal in the two prior times were just rubber stamps. They didn't even have a discussion in the Senate and the House worthy of the name. Now I think maybe there'll be some opposition to renewing some of its provisions, such as snooping on your library borrowings or being able to sneak and peek, that is, search your home and not tell you for 72 hours. We can see left-right converging at the state level on juvenile justice reform, on the war on drugs. We see it at the state level successfully. In juvenile justice, 15 states have already passed it. That couldn't have happened without conservative and liberal legislators. And after the Supreme Court decision on eminent domain that said New London could take an entire neighborhood and give it to Pfizer, about 24 states passed laws saying not in these states. You're not going to take private property and give it to corporate property. Taking private property is only for public uses like roads and bridges and tunnels and schools, etc. So that's the thrust of my book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Coalition Alliance, rather, to dismantle the corporate state. It's important. It's not just a coalition to achieve anything. It's to dismantle the corporate state and its takeover of our government, a lot of our culture, the commercialization of childhood with bad stuff being sold, little kids undermining and bypassing parental authority. That's a big one, too. So I think it's already out there in the minds of people who call themselves conservatives and liberals. The challenge is to turn it operational. Some of it is already operational. We won the Whistleblower Protection Act last year against corporate lobbyists, giving federal employees rights to blow the whistle on corporate fraud on government programs like Medicare and military contracts. Some of it is just beginning to congeal, beginning to get media attention, like the juvenile justice issues. And some of it is still in the minds of tens of millions of conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat Americans. It hasn't yet gone operational. But I have a chapter on how to fund it. I have a chapter not sugarcoating the whole issue, taking one obstacle after another, discussing it, and showing how it can be overcome. So I think it's an exciting book. It's designed to be read by people who are readers and are serious about this country, its future, its role in the world.
Yes, I think you have written the most exciting and important book of the generation, Unstoppable, and I hope all our listeners will read it. You have been a leading activist since the 1960s, and there were some left-right coalitions then. What's the biggest success you have had personally with a left-right coalition?
Well, I think it's been numerous successes. We stopped things like the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in 1983 that General Electric, Westinghouse, Ronald Reagan, and Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee, that's where the plant was going to be. It was a huge boondoggle. It was a stunning upset, 56-40, in the Senate because of a left-right coalition in Washington. We should remember that the auto safety law passed almost unanimously in the Congress in 1966, and that certainly dismantled the power of the auto companies to decide what level of hazard or safety you were going to have to buy when you purchased a car. The 1986 False Claims Act, that's returned tens of billions of dollars from fraudulent contracting with the federal government to the taxpayer. And that was a left-right as well. That was between Senator Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Congressman Howard Berman, Democrat from California. They got together and they beat the corporate lobbies. Just last year, there was a left-right upsurge in defiance of their leadership in the House of Representatives. They defied John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, just missed by 12 votes, banning NSA dragnet snooping on all Americans. And they blocked, the left-right alliance did block the plunge to war in Syria last year. That's up for renewal, obviously. So I think you see it happening in not just in legislatures. You see it happening in the kind of cultural revulsion to the exploitation of children by corporations, junk food, junk drink, obesity, diabetes, just sweeping aside parental authority, direct marketing to 8, 7, 6, 5-year-olds. I think that's a big one that's coming up. There is a left-right alliance in the courtrooms to have more ballot access for third-party candidates. For example, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party have teamed up, not just in the courtroom, but to also lobby state legislatures to loosen up a bit and let the voters get more choices and more issues and more agenda instead of just being confronted with increasingly similar Democrat and Republican parties dialing for the same commercial dollars. I think there's a left-right alliance going back years for the initiative referendum recall type of government at the state level. And, of course, the opposition to the big banks that are too big to fail and the desire to break them up, that comes in about 90% in the polls, as well as prosecuting Wall Street crooks who got away with it in 2008.
Right. So you've mentioned, you know, some of the emerging left-right coalitions there. Where do you see the biggest energy? Do you think, is it kind of geographically some area in the country? Is it local? Is it national? Or where's the biggest energy coming from for the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
It's scattered, actually. I can't locate it. Okay. For example, the Koch brothers are lobbying southern legislators to put a surcharge tax on solar panels, because now solar panels are being applied to roofs everywhere, and they're challenging the Koch brothers' gas and oil interests. Well, they're not winning, and that's because, you know, you have Republicans and Democrats say, what? I mean, you know, we want solar panels. We don't want them burdened by taxation. The way the oil and gas industry has been coddled by the federal government with all kinds of tax breaks and loopholes and subsidies. So there it is, right in the conservative South. So it depends on the issue. I do want to see it go really big time, because I don't see any other political realignment likely emerging in the next 12 years that actually gets things done for the American people, other than a left-right alliance. So I'll take it wherever it comes up. But I do urge some enlightened billionaires to begin funding citizen advocacy groups that only focus on convergent issues. That is, they don't have any other agenda. They're not fighting left-right. They only go to work every day to push this left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, project by project.
Right. I think you put your finger on the key challenge in our country right now, because no matter what issue you might be concerned about, whether it's wanting more renewable energy and less of the fossil fuels, or, you know, changes in health care, or whatever it is you're looking for, the influence of the corporations is so profound in Washington, D.C., that it's distorting every area of policy. So we must address this, and you're so right that left and right see it. It's just, as you say in your book, rightly, there's no one who that's what their job is, to focus on building these left-right coalitions. So you call for creating several institutions, but basically having an institutional base for this kind of convergence work, that with an organization or organizations that would have staying power. Have you had much response to that critical idea, and are you working with any group to found such an institution?
Well, we're looking for some rich people to fund it. Foundations aren't likely to. They don't like this issue. They're usually, you know, they're usually either left or right. Foundations are liberal and conservative. So we're looking for individually wealthy people who have a sense that their country is going the wrong way and that they're not going to hand it in very good shape to their children and grandchildren. So there is a tiny percent of the many billionaires that are around these days, especially as they grow older and, you know, have a different take on what they want to leave behind other than a pile of gold. That's what we're looking for, and it doesn't take that much. I mean, when you see what the Koch brothers have funded in terms of think tanks, or Mr. Skay for the Mellon interests, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, it really doesn't take that much. So if anybody has any leads, we're all ears. But it's going to go on anyway. I think the most exciting on the ground is the support for community-rooted businesses, credit unions, community banks, farmer-to-consumer markets, local renewable energy, community health clinics that focus on prevention. Every time we spend our money, our consumer dollars, with these entities, we're taking away money from Bank of America, Pfizer, big hospital chains, agribusiness. That's called the displacement movement, and that really is conservative liberal. I mean, you don't find conservatives refusing to go to farmer markets because they want to patronize some giant supermarket chain.
Right, and that leads right into my next question: is what about our listeners? You know, what can we do? You know, we're feeling kind of overwhelmed by the power of these corporations, the Koch brothers, the billions that are being spent to, you know, advance the interests of the corporations over the people, in spite of broad support among the people for various policies and so forth. We keep losing in Washington, so. What are the top things that are, like, the top three things that our listeners could do to deal with this whole thing and support the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
Well, one, you can get a victory next year, because when President Obama sends the Pacific Trade Agreement to Congress, I think right now we have a majority in the House to block it of left-right, in defiance, by the way, of John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, their leaders. However, you know, the lobbyists will try to spin off some of these. So if you want to tie what I'm going to recommend now to a victory, to begin the first rollback of these corporate-managed globalized trade agreements that have sucked so many jobs and industries out of our country to dictatorial regimes abroad, what you can do is find someone who is opposite you. You know, if you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, find your opposite and print a letterhead. You can give it a nice title. You can say the Left-Right Alliance in the 21st Congressional District of New York, and then get a few people also on the letterhead, and then send the first letter to your representative and your two senators. And you can use some of the arguments in this book. You can pick the issues, and then you start increasing your civic skills and how to write a powerful letter and how to bring it to the attention of the member when they come back into your area for trying to ask for your vote. So it's like a little club. It's a lot of fun. You'll meet people you haven't met before. You might help each other get more enlightened on your issues. And you will see the magic of a left-right confrontation with your member of Congress. They really turn pale when they see a left-right coming in at them, because they can't manipulate left against right or right against left, because they can't go the easy way because they're in a red state. You know, they just pander to the right, or in a blue state to the left, and get campaign contributions accordingly. It sort of perplexes them. I've seen that happen on Capitol Hill. When a staffer says to a senator in the morning, we're getting a huge number of emails, and the senator says, oh, from our supporters, eh? And the staffer says, no, it's coming in left, right. You can't believe the impact. So everything starts with a couple people. Everything starts with a conversation. And now you can start with a letterhead and actually focus it on blocking the Pacific Trade Agreement, because you can get all the information you need by going to globaltradewatch.org, globaltradewatch.org. That's one of our groups, and it lays out all the issues, the arguments. You have a lot of fun. It's fun to build power. It's not fun to have to swallow your grievances and go through life feeling that you don't matter and you don't count. Start the letterhead group.
That sounds great. And then in terms of establishing an institution that focuses on convergence with left and right on this set of issues, you mention in the book that we would start that by maybe spinning off staff and resources from an existing organization and create a new organization where convergence is the only mission. Do you know any specific organizations that you think would be kind of a starting point for that kind of a spinoff?
Yeah, I think ours would offer, you know, the idea is to get like 10 organizations donating one full-time person around a explicit converging agenda, so they know what they're getting into. And that's possible. You know, Heritage is quite wealthy, Cato, Public Citizen, I could put one in. There'd be others, people for the American Way. And let's say they all decide they're going to work on five issues, like civil liberties, like corporate welfare and bailouts, like prison reform, maybe anti-war, whatever they all agree on. And that will get it underway.
I think that sounds great. And have any of those conversations started to happen among those organizations?
Well, I've gone over to Cato for a very good session. It was very successful. I want to do it in Heritage before I put the question to them. I've asked Grover Norquist. He could do it. He says he's going to think about it, because I was with him at a National Press Club function a few days ago that was relayed on radio around the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it might happen. Remember, these are the groups that have other priorities that are funded that animate them day by day, and they're mm-hmm. usually the priorities of conflict, that is, against one another, not the priorities of convergence. For example, the priorities of conflict would be Heritage and Cato would be against regulating further the coal industry or the nuclear industry, and the liberal side would be for it. So you see, that's the only thing restraining them. It isn't lack of money. So we'll try it. That's why I'm looking for an independent-minded, enlightened billionaire or two.
Right. Well, if we had one, it would get us going. And you write in the book a letter to a billionaire saying exactly what you want to do and where the money would go. So the hunt is on. Is there any other way you see it being funded besides the, you know, a billionaire, or maybe start with some more modest funding and hopefully attract a billionaire into the game?
It could. It could start with just two people. Each side donates one funds for a full-time staff and start with two people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they all agree on is that the Pentagon budget is unauditable. Every year, the Government Accountability Office of the U.S. Congress, which is the auditing office of government agencies in the executive branch, has to report that the Pentagon does not provide them with the data that would allow them to be audited. And the Pentagon admits this. They don't even know how these dollars are being spent with any precision. So every few years, the Pentagon says, we'll do it. The latest postponement is 2017. We'll get it by 2017. Well, that probably comes in close to 100% left-right. I mean, half of the federal discretionary budget, apart from Medicare and Medicaid, but half of all the departments and agencies' budget is Pentagon. And there's no major enemy. There's no Soviet Union, you know, that requires heavy-duty systems of weapon destruction and all. And so I think that would really come in. I like that one. And, of course, when you do that, you discover all kinds of waste and corruption, and you can strain tens of billions of dollars out of this $800 billion monster to apply to repairing America at communities all over the country, creating good-paying jobs that can't be exported.
And just so our listeners know, in your book, Unstoppable, you actually name 25 specific areas that the left and right could work on together. And you've mentioned several of them here. Auditing the Pentagon would be a huge one. Getting tough on the corporate crime, you know, checking out just where are all these corporate bonanza bailouts and subsidies and tax breaks, kind of what are they, and stop it. So there's a roster. You've kind of laid out the agenda. That's a good starting point. If we get some folks together, have the conversation across left-right, and just let's pick, you know, one, two, or three of those to start working on.
Yes. I think another big one is giving investors more power over the company executives whose company they own. I mean, the people who own these giant corporations have no power over the people who run them, whose huge bonuses and salaries they're forced to pay. So people left-right are really angry about these gigantic executive salaries that they're giving to themselves with their rubber-stamp board of directors. That's a good one for convergence.
Right, and of the issues that you map out there, you're looking at things that have maybe 60, 70, 80%, maybe more of Americans would support that program. So
yeah, that's right.
It's amazing that we live in a so-called democracy, but issues that have that much support are not moving through Congress, or if they are, they're going in an opposite direction.
Yeah, that's the strategy of the ruling powers, of the plutocracy or oligarch. They want to divide and rule. There's nothing new about that. It's been going on for over 2,000 years. The way you deal with the people is to divide them and pit them against one another on issues they really disagree about, and not at all focus on the very important issues that they do agree about. So left-right disagrees on reproductive rights, gun control, constitutionally required balanced budget, school prayer. We know all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the powers love to focus on that. But they know what happens when the people throw off the chains and say, we're going to focus on right down on Main Street and take on Wall Street. And we're going to focus on things that we agree on that can make a better life for everyone. We're up against another convergence, the convergence of the corporate Democrats represented by the Clintons, who are corporatists and militarists, Hillary the hawk, and the corporate Republicans like John Boehner and Senator McConnell and Senator Graham and so forth. They all work together. They push through crony capitalism. They push through wars of empire. They push through tax breaks for the giant corporations and their super wealthy patrons. So that's what we have to break apart. But, you know, they have a lot of money and power, but we have the votes. The left-right alliance has the votes. It's just it has to go operational around redirections for our country.
Right, absolutely. And you mentioned Grover Norquist. I'm curious what he thinks of Unstoppable.
He likes it. He gave a blurb for the back of the book, and I'm going to start with him. I think he's a likely person, and he's got a lot of baggage. Of course, he's against unions, and He's against taxes on corporations and individuals. On the other hand, he's against empire, and he's against corporate welfare or crony capitalism, and he's very strong on civil liberties. So, I mean, those are pretty good starts, I must say. And I don't think he likes the Federal Reserve running amok either. So those are good starts.
Fantastic. Well, I so appreciate what you're doing, and your book really is kind of a blueprint and lays out, you know we've got corporate government convergence in favor of the corporations. We can confront that and change that with a convergence among left and right on issues and approaches that can help the majority of the American people and help our country move forward. So
thank you so much. If they want an autographed copy, they can just go to nader.org. And see how you can get an autographed copy of the book if you want to give it to a student or a relative as a gift. Anything to get discussions going. Everything starts with conversation.
Absolutely. I encourage all our listeners to get the book, Unstoppable. Read it. Get a group together in your neighborhood. Get your friends together. Read it and talk about it and see what you can do and how you can be part of taking back America.
And you can sign up for my free weekly column by going to the same website, nader.org. Thank you.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Ralph Nader, thank you so much for coming on All Together Now.
And thank you, everybody. That was Eleanor LeCain interviewing Ralph Nader on Progressive Radio Network back in September. And joining us this evening is Eleanor LeCain herself. She is also an author of her own book called Breakthrough Solutions, where she has real-life examples of cross-spectrum coalitions. And our second guest tonight is Joan Blades, who most people know as the co-founder of MoveOn.org, but she's also co-founded Living Room Conversations and another little organization called Moms Rising. So I want to welcome Eleanor and Joan both to the call tonight.
Wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it had been a little while since I'd listened to that interview that you did, Eleanor, with Ralph, and wow, what a lot of ground you covered.
Yes, Ralph Nader was a fantastic guest, and actually I haven't listened to it myself since that interview, but it was so rich, he's so deep and so broad, he's just incredible, and his book Unstoppable really is a blueprint for how we can get left and right together to help get the Congress and government moving in a way that improves things for the average Americans and Main Street, not just Wall Street.
Right. And Joan, one of the reasons I asked Joan to join us on this call tonight, as we actually do what Ralph was talking about at the end of the show there, which was getting together and having conversations, is that Joan, as you know, a longtime activist, has some experience. And so I wanted to kind of play with that, like, what has she experienced at work? So, Joan, do you want to, like, comment on a little bit on Ralph's interview?
I guess the part I really keyed into is I had a living room conversation, which I co-hosted with a Tea Party Patriots co-founder, Mark Meckler, and we absolutely found all sorts of common ground in the crony capitalism realm. I didn't actually know that. I took notes that there's different terminology, and I've been calling it crony capitalism, and it is a progressive. I should be using different corporate welfare or something. So I've got to update my terminology here. But, you know, we did. He had two of his friends. I had two of my friends. And our conversation about crony capitalism identified we had a huge amount in common on issues of criminal justice reform, that nobody in the room thought that we should be insuring the banks so that they could gamble with our money and get reimbursed when they lost and get to keep it when they won. So I am excited and encouraged by the potential for citizens to engage and create real connections so that we can work together. And I'm starting to experience that.
And we are, just for sake of clarity, everybody, I do work with Joan at Living Room Conversations. This is part of our mission in the country, is to get people from different diverse perspectives to talk to one another, and so we kind of live that. We have a couple of comments that came in on our website, on the Coffee Party website, about book club. And one of them from Coffee Party supporter Paige Forth was talking about lobbyists and reining in the power of lobbyists. Eleanor, do you want to talk about what do you think the proper role of a lobbyist is?
Well, I think there is a proper role for lobbyists where people's different views need to be represented. We've had great lobbyists in D.C. for the disability community, for example, which helped to pass the Americans for Disability Act, which has opened up opportunity for millions of people. So there is a constructive role there for people getting together for whatever their shared concern is and bringing it to the attention of the lawmakers in Congress. But the problem we have here in Washington, D.C. is that the lobbying power is so heavily weighted to the wealthy corporations. You know, things like the weapons companies can have at least one lobbyist for every member of the House and Senate all they do is figure out, you know, what kind of pizza do they like and send it over when there's late night sessions, or, you know, what kind of wine do they like and, you know, when is their daughter getting married, you know, all that stuff. They can get very detailed about where and how to cultivate support, and it so distorts our whole public policy making process.
Yeah, that just, oh, man, I just, that gets me all riled up. Joan, do you want to talk a little bit about lobbyists and what you think their proper role is?
Well, I'm a big believer in citizen lobbyists. Those are the ones I like very best of all. So I'm always looking for citizens to show up and represent themselves and their peers. Which is what we do at Moms Rising and Move On.
Uh-huh.
So I am frustrated by the power of money in the system, because I've seen that there's so much that happens due to the influence of the lobbyists that can show up because they are deeply funded and they know that they can also offer funding, not pizza, as well, to legislators, which is not a direct quid pro quo, but everybody knows what's going on behind the curtain.
Right. Well, exactly. I mean, they've made it, I mean, it's gotten to the point where we've tried to do restrictions on, like, what lobbyists can provide, you know. And it's gotten to the silly point where if there's a reception or something, the value of the food is counted. So all the receptions in Washington, D.C. now are all finger food, or you have toothpicks, because if you have food that requires a fork, it's too much money. I was at one of these receptions last week, and it was silly. I was trying to eat this, like, piece of prosciutto with a toothpick. It was silly. It was not effective, but I guess that's what I should say. It didn't feel like it was effective for trying to cut back from lobbyists. But getting back to Ralph Nader's book, Unstoppable, here, I'm looking at this list of the 25 proposed redirections and reforms through convergent action. And I have some favorites that I highlighted in the book, and I'm taking just a minute to get there. One of them, let me ask you too, if you remember any of your favorites while it takes me a second to get through my Kindle to the pages I have highlighted.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight the one that both Ralph Nader mentioned and that Grover Norquist supports, and that Joan Blades mentioned in her wonderful Living Room Conversations, and that is to find our common ground on stopping crony capitalism and corporate welfare. There is just such a huge amount of money that gets sent out of our federal treasury every year, and it's really to fatten the coffers of corporations, most of whom don't need it. I mean, you look at ExxonMobil, for example, one of the largest, most profitable countries in the history of the world, and yet taxpayers subsidize ExxonMobil and other oil and gas companies to the tune of billions of dollars every year. And it's such a great way to stop the excessive spending by government in those kinds of areas, and then that frees up funds to both pay off the debt and to create jobs in productive areas like fixing our crumbling infrastructure and funding education, like the president just said in the State of the Union about free community college for students. You know, there's so much better ways we could be spending the money instead of fattening the coffers of the already wealthy corporation. And, you know, having read The Unstoppable book and thought about this for quite a while, I think I would put a movement to stop crony capitalism and corporate welfare kind of at the top of the list.
Yeah. Well, I actually love that one. The other one that I really liked, and John, I'll give you a chance to answer after this, was to enhance civic skills and experience for students. Because to me, if our kids don't know about the role of a citizen in our country, we may as well give it up now. I mean, there's already people who say we're no longer a democracy, we're just an oligarchy. But to me, the lack of civic education and citizen training, if you will, in our schools has been a big thing. Joan, what do you think? Do you remember some that you liked a lot?
Well, I seem to recall there was something about reducing the defense spending budget.
The auditing of the Defense Department.
That has always been dear to my heart. And that's a huge percentage of the federal budget.
Yeah, it's half or 51% or something like that right now. And until I read this book, I actually didn't know that was unauditable. It's so big or so out of control, if you will, that our government accounting offices can't even audit the Department of Defense.
And clearly auditing is one approach, but I think there are multiple approaches to, reducing our expenditures on defense spending. Defense spending is, even the language, let's be honest, it's weapons making. We have made it sound much nicer than it really is.
Absolutely. It reminds me of, I think it was Dennis Kucinich's, I can't even say his name right, but he was trying to propose a Department of Peace where we would actually put money towards peaceful and infrastructure. Actually, it's part of civic infrastructure building to actually create a place where peace is the conversation.
Well, I think Joan's exactly right. You know, cutting the military spending is a major area. It is a half of the discretionary budget. 50% of the federal budget every year, the discretionary budget, is spent on weapons and military. And it's not even what's needed to make America safe. I was in a dining room dinner party here in D.C. with high-ranking people from the Navy. It was an admiral from the Navy and a very high-ranking person in the Army, and asked them what percentage of the military budget is going to, what the weapons companies want to make and kind of payoffs to get Congress members to vote for them, and what percentage is what we really need to keep America safe and strong. And they both said that 100% of the military budget was going, for what they could get passed through Congress and to make sure members of Congress had jobs at stake, so therefore would vote for the budget. And they as warriors, were worried about the state of the U.S. military, that we weren't having the military weaponry and systems being focused on what we really needed to be safe. So I think it's such a great area to focus on. And there was the New York Times published the federal budget once on a page and invited citizens to say, okay, if you were in charge of the federal budget, where would you cut, and to make room for what's needed, both to reduce the deficit spending and to strengthen the country. So I took my pencil and I thought, okay, I'll sit down and I'll work on this over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And what I realized is within 15 minutes I had it all done. And all I had to do was cut the military spending and cut back on the crony capitalism and corporate welfare, and that freed up hundreds of billions of dollars that then could be used to both cut deficit spending and to fund education and fund green technology and fund our infrastructure and strengthen our families and our mm-hmm. communities. So it's actually not that complicated. If you took those two things, and you know, that's what I would recommend for the Left-Right Alliance, I would start with those two things would be the major shifts. If you could even make a little bit of progress on cutting back on crony capitalism and cutting back on the excessive military spending, you could make a huge difference in life in America.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eleanor. Hey, I want to take a quick little break here and play a book club promo, and then when we come back, I'm going to take a caller because we have somebody from area code 714 on the line that's been waiting with us since the middle of the Nader interview. And Janine, if you could hit the book club promo, because I'm not sure it'll work on my computer tonight, that would be great, and then we'll take a caller.
Okay, you love books. You believe in your country, and you want to be involved, but you're sick of the politics. So try this. Join the Coffee Party USA Book Club and share your thoughts and comments with readers across America. Here's how it works. The Coffee Party USA selects a book each month. Buy it from your local bookstore or online and let us know you're going to be part of this book's discussion. Send us some of your thoughts and questions and listen to Coffee Party USA Internet Radio. Hear the authors or a discussion about the book and just be involved. It's that simple. So just click on the Coffee Party USA Book Club link here at Danahy.com or join directly at coffeepartyusa.com/book_club_signup. Something's happening out there. People are getting involved. You should too. coffeepartyusa.com.
And so this is our first book club call. So I hope everybody comes back again and listens. And participate some more and starts with the conversation. And right now, I just opened up the mic for area code 714. Could you please tell us your name and where you're calling from?
This is Michael Maxenti, and I'm calling from Irvine in Orange County, California.
Well, hello, Michael. I know you.
Yes. Hi, Deb. Hi, Joan. And hi, Eleanor. I greatly appreciate the book club and its choice of Ralph Nader's Unstoppable. And I did want to add a comment here, as I think it's I love Ralph Nader and what he's done in his efforts so far, and his 25 proposed areas for convergence are outstanding food for thought in areas that I believe much progress can be made. However, it's nice to think of these taking on issue by issue, and that's easy to say for those who are living comfortably, but for those who are living in very difficult circumstances that have made for many impossible over the last 7 years almost, it's not something that can just be issue by issue in a lot of time. And so many people are enslaved today with debt, and they don't have the luxury of issue by issue thinking. Something that I believe that we could do is to, and to your point, Debbie, about, you know, civic skills in students, is to inspire the American people with the realization that nothing, including the founding of our country, ever came easy, but it was done with ordinary people when they said enough is enough and were determined. All the way to the civil rights movement and every major movement in between has always been by ordinary people and their determination. And Alex de Tocqueville said it well one time when he said, "The evil that one endures patiently because it seems inevitable becomes unbearable the moment its elimination becomes conceivable." Think about that for a moment. I believe the tipping point and the opportunity presents itself clearly to us in 2016 with the election of our next president and the opportunity to, when both parties could be taken out of control of the Senate and where a coalition that started with the No Labels effort there could be built between the L's and R's and a few independents, so that a president who was elected that would represent the people's interests, not be the leader of a party, that those three changes, they could then make the type of electoral changes necessary to dramatically begin to open up the process so that all of these other issues, these 25 proposed areas and many, many more, could then be heard with a level of integrity and real solutions could be found and we could really begin to move ahead. And that point of convergence is what we're at right now, mm-hmm. as two rivers coming together. Soon as we
Michael,
get beyond this point, it'll be
Do
wonderful.
You have a URL you want to throw out there for people to find out more information about what you're talking about? Because I know you've been working on this for a while.
There really is not yet, but we're in the process of trying to do, as he suggested there, about getting some organizations together to focus on this one major issue of electoral reform, to use that as a tool to bring out the leaders who are going to put their names forward to run for president, to see who there could carry the banner. Is it somebody like a Gary
mm-hmm.
Johnson, a John Huntsman? There's many people coming forward. And to see who out there will really become someone who could be seen as a leader of the people, not a leader of a party.
You're right. I'm here, and I know that's something that there's a lot of us independents out there that we're waiting for, and so I really appreciate the work that you're doing on that. Did you have any questions or any comments that you want John and Eleanor to reflect upon?
I would just like their comments and yours on that thinking, that this
mm-hmm.
the 2016 is the time. We don't have that, you know, the luxury of these others, and that we can do this in 2016.
John, you want to take that one first?
Well, and I am in the space right now where I'm very interested in having citizens talking to each other and finding their common ground. I don't honestly know if that's where people are right now. If that's, and so I don't feel like I have the background.
Mm-hmm.
I know I want to find a place where we are having everybody feeling like they're represented properly, but there's history in the electoral process that a lot of people are looking for ways to fix it, and I'm looking forward to having those conversations and learning from them because it's not my area of expertise.
Right. Thanks, Joan. Eleanor, do you have comments?
Well, I think there's a lot that needs to be done in a lot of different areas. I agree with Michael that it is always the ordinary people that are bringing about change, and it really is up to us all to be taking action on what we feel motivated to do. But I was struck, there was recently a description of the incoming members of this new Congress, and I don't remember the exact percentages, but it said, you know, X percentage were Republican and Y percentage were Democrats. And then they compared that to the registered voters, and there's 41% of the American electorate is now registered as independent, and there's only one independent in the Senate. So, you know, that huge section of American people are not feeling represented by their current choices with the Democrat or Republican. So I think, you know, something is going to have to change there electorally. But I don't think you start with a basis of electoral reform. In my experience, it's not something that people generally get passionate about. People will get passionate about some particular issue like the corporate welfare or the military overspending. And then they recognize in order to make progress on that, they must do electoral reform. So I think it would be electoral reform be a secondary issue for pretty much everyone. No matter what issue you care about, you're going to come around to electoral reform as your next concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add my two cents on there, I was actually was meeting with somebody last week who was talking about electoral reform, and he was talking about our system and how it is right now. So he described to me a process that he went through at a conference. And what he said is, we're going to experiment with three different voting processes as we decide what we're having for dinner. So for the starter course, there's two choices, and whichever one gets the most votes, that's what we're having for our starter course. And so they did that, and of course half the people got something they didn't want. Then on the main course, he said, okay, now we're going to do top two. So there's five choices, and the top two are, we're going to have half and half. Everybody, we're going to have five selections again, and vote for whichever one you want, and then we're going to put three out. Oh, I'm sorry, this is ranked four. And vote for two. So out of five, vote for two, and we're going to have three desserts. So the top three out of those five choices is what we're having. So everybody pretty much got something that they liked. It was either their first or second choice on dessert. They had to choose between two things for dinner, and they may or may not have wanted it. And for the starter course, which is like our current election system, everybody, half the people lost, if you will. And I thought it was a really interesting demonstration on what our electoral system is like now, and the need for a structural change in how we vote and how we decide who wins, so that the most people feel like they're represented. And so, Michael, I hope those are some words of wisdom for you. And I've got another caller that I'm going to go ahead and move on to, but I really appreciate you calling in and taking the time to bring this to our attention. And when you do get a URL, Michael, send it to us, and we'll make sure it gets out there. And right now I'm going to open the mic for area code 267. If you could start with your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Skip Moyer. I'm from Quakertown, Pennsylvania.
Well, welcome to the show, Skip. So you've been listening into our book club tonight and had some questions for us, for Eleanor or Joan?
Well, yeah, more of a comment, but I mean, I love the idea of electoral reform and taking money out of politics. I think it's the first thing we probably need to do. I mean, Lawrence Lessig has the idea that no other issue is going to be dealt with unless we take money out of politics, because the money is just so evil, and will just prevent any attempt to try to take it away. But my other point was that I think we might do a lot better if we organize more locally. Ralph had talked about creating congressional watchdog groups where you might have 300 people, at least starting with 300 people, in a congressional district where those people would be like-minded, maybe around an issue, and lobby all the representatives, not just Congress or Senate, but their state representatives, their state Senate, governor, you know, everyone. And I was thinking of doing that as an email group or as you can do it online. So, and the idea being is that if you did one congressional district, you could let that bleed into another and have many different groups that would be independent, that would be maybe connected loosely so they could exchange ideas. Because another issue that Ralph brings up, he used the metaphor of a baseball diamond in trying to get legislation through. He said, you know, the powers that be will let you get to maybe second base. But on the way from second to third, these big corporations are going to put a stop to you. You know, they're going to find a way to either shut you up or, you know, keep you out of the game. And my thought was that if you had many targets and too many targets, that it would be tougher for corporations to stop you. But it would be important for, like the organizations of the Coffee Party or, you know, and there's another one, there's others out there, to maybe invite people to organize more locally so they can at least have a face and talk amongst themselves. That was my comment.
Well, thank you, Skip. And I saw, I think you had posted that online, and I wasn't sure how to
yeah.
present that in the show. So thank
okay.
you for calling in and doing it yourself. And I just want to comment real quick before we close the show out that we're starting a bill club with Coffee Party so that people can get together and talk about actual legislation. It's right now targeted for April, and it depends a little bit on our volunteer time. So I think, Skip, for you, that's going to be something to help organize around, and you can create that coalition and perhaps even use living room conversations to do it, to put forth, like, you know, to send the Left-Right Alliance letterhead, if you will, to your congressional representatives and start organizing that way. So I hope that we can provide some tools to help with that. Joan, I'm going to give you last words here, and then we're going to close out the show. I'll go to Eleanor next, and then we'll close.
Well, thank you so much for letting me be part of this. I wish we could have living room conversations about each of the issues that we brought up. And we've had some about some of them, but
mm-hmm.
the opportunity, I think, is for hundreds and even thousands of conversations all around the country because, yeah, I agree, the local engagement and just creating relationships that we don't have right now as we have been living in homogenized and separate narratives for too long, I think it could be incredibly powerful. And I love Coffee Party for your commitment to overcoming that.
Well, thanks, Joan. You know, I've already drunk the Kool-Aid with you on the let's get together and find common ground. So thank you so much for being with us, Joan. Eleanor, last thoughts?
Yes, I just want to say a big shout-out to Joan Blades for your great work initially with Move On and now currently with your living room conversations, bringing together left, right, independent. You're just such a wonderful American, and you bring so much hope and inspiration to me and to millions. So thank you for all you've done and all you continue to do. And Debbie Lynn, a big thank you to you for your work with the Coffee Party, organizing this book club, and I'm honored to be part of it and help kick it off. I think Ralph Nader's book, Unstoppable, is critically important. I hope everyone listening and every American would read it and get inspired for finding that common ground to help America move forward, because it is, you know, people united will never be defeated.
Hear, hear. And just to quote Margaret Mead, you know, people's something about a small group of people is the only thing that's really made a difference in the world. Vastly paraphrased. But with that, this is Debbie Lynn Molyneux with the Coffee Party Book Club, our inaugural show. And we look forward to seeing you next month where we're going to be reviewing a book called Reclaiming... Oh, hold on. I just lost it. It was in my head. Reclaiming Civility in the Public Square. That's it. Reclaiming Civility in the Public Square. It'll be the book club selection for next month, and we'll be interviewing the authors Cassandra Donkey and Tomas Sporath. I hope I said that right. Until then, have a great evening, and coffee party on.
Slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last. Just kicking down the cobblestones. Looking for fun and feeling good.